Well, welcome. It's Monday in the summertime here in Franklin, Tennessee, prime vacation time. I'm Nate Larkin, your host, and this is the Pirate Monk Podcast from SamsonSociety.org. David Mullen's not here. I am here, however, with our fearless engineer, everybody's favorite Samson guy, Mondo. This is a special edition of the Pirate Monk Podcast. In just a few minutes, we're going to play an interview with my bride, Allie. The interview that hundreds, if not thousands, have asked me for over the last few years, Allie finally breaks her silence and speaks publicly. That'll be a neat thing. But before we get to the Allie interview, we have a listener letter to respond to. This letter, which we read last week, came from one of our female listeners. She wrote, "Thank you for your podcast. My husband and I listen to it every week and are extremely grateful. I have a question about confrontation. Do you have any advice to wives about how to confront their husbands? Obviously in a respectful manner, but what do you suggest? What would that look like exactly?" Well, that's a great question. I'm not sure that any one answer fits every situation, but from my own experience and from the experience of several of my friends, I think that I can give you some helpful principles. First of all, let me say that I do believe that confrontation is appropriate. I don't think that a wife should sit silently by while her husband destroys himself and gravely injures the relationship by indulging in lust, even if he's only using pornography. It's easy for guys to rationalize porn use, to say that it's better than the alternative of adultery. Jesus seemed to indicate that there's not a great distinction between the two. I'm not going to say that a guy who's using porn is committing adultery, but he certainly is indulging in lust, which is not only a sin, it's not bad because God says not to do it. God says not to do it because it's bad. It's destructive. Lust kills love. It eats away at the integrity of a relationship. It kills a man's soul, and it affects his wife. So if a wife becomes aware that her husband is using porn, I do think that if she cares about him, cares about the marriage, if she cares about what God wants, she has an obligation to say something. The question is, how should she say it? Well, I believe that our listener is really onto something when she says that it should be done in a respectful manner. By that, I think it's really important, ladies, that you not shame your husband. This is not something to be dealt with publicly. Don't embarrass the guy by doing it in front of friends. Even if he's not around. One of the things that I really appreciated about my wife is that even when she was aware of my problems with lust, she did not shop those to all her friends. I didn't go to church or go out into public with the knowledge that every one of my wife's friends who was looking at me knew what I was doing. It made it easier for me to respond. Love covers a multitude of sins, and if you love your husband, you are going to offer him some cover, even as, in a loving manner, you help him come to grips with a sin that's destroying him and affecting you. By the way, just to give you some added incentive, our good friends at PornAddictHubby.com have pointed out that 4 out of every 5 guys who enter recovery for sex addiction or sexually compulsive behavior do so only after receiving an ultimatum from a wife and a girlfriend. You might be able to put a guy out of his misery. He's probably wrestling with a ton of guilt and shame anyway. You can help push him over the edge, help him reach that point of crisis by telling him that you're not going to put up with it anymore. Which is not the same as telling him that you don't love him. I still remember, it hasn't left my mind in 12 years, that crucial night when Allie confronted me. I remember those words and will remember them till the day I die. She said, I still love you, but I don't like you. I don't trust you. I don't respect you. And I don't believe you can ever change. Now, those words came from a woman who had lived with me for 20 years. She didn't leap to conclusions about the severity of my problem. She knew it at this point. She knew it well. And to be honest, if she hadn't said those words to me, I never would have left my private world and actually sought help. I only sought help in a desperate attempt to save my marriage. Interestingly, as you'll hear in the interview in just a few minutes, she wasn't going to divorce me, and she made it clear. This wasn't a rejection thing. But she wasn't going to live in a pretend marriage any longer. She wanted something real. Anyway, wives, my advice, if you've got a husband who's not yet acknowledged his problem, you have a role in helping him acknowledge it. Make it safe for him. Don't do it publicly. Let him know that you care about him, even though you are deeply hurt and angry. Tell him what you know and demand that he do something about it. At that point, and this is where it's crucial, ladies, as soon as he actually seeks help, finds brothers, you need to step away from the process. It's my firm belief that a wife cannot function effectively long term as her husband's accountability partner in matters sexual. If you turn into the porn cop in the relationship, you will drive yourself crazy, you'll drive him crazy, and you'll drive the marriage straight into the ground. You have the leverage to insist that he get help. But you're probably the one person in the world least qualified to help him. You need to show loyalty and love and support. That's a crucial role that you play. And in addition to pushing him toward repentance, you need to show him that you're repenting too. That's another, I think, just a vital ingredient of a healthy marriage that's moving toward healing. Both members need to understand that they are sinners in equal need of grace. Yes, his problem is serious, but lust is no more serious. Sexual lust is no more serious than lust in any other form. And I don't care what a wonderful, fine Christian lady you are, how much you love Jesus, you still have issues to deal with. You have sins to repent of. You're on a journey of your own. And it will be a huge encouragement to your husband as he sees you maintain an attitude, a humble attitude of daily repentance. You give him the example of working on your own stuff. And once you are certain that he is walking with brothers, you allow him to walk that way. It's your job not to co-sign his baloney. If he's telling you that he has an accountability partner and he doesn't, that he's working a program of recovery and he isn't. My advice is don't allow him to fool you and don't pretend that things are what they aren't. But if you're married to a guy who is sincerely seeking help and making progress, then be a friend. You've been deeply wounded by what he's done, I'm certain. But I hope that you are willing to love again, that you're moving graciously toward healing and asking God to heal your heart. It may be that the two of you need to withdraw from each other sexually for a time. He may need that in order to recover from lust. There might be some detox there. It may be a while before he can actually make love. Love being the operative word. But even if you're not having sexual contact, you can still reassure him with physical touch and with gentleness and affection where you can give it. Doesn't mean you have to hide your anger, but you can leaven your anger with affection. Anyway, that's my advice for what it's worth. My sympathies, ladies, to all of you who are married to guys who struggle with lust. And my sympathies, guys, to all of you who are married to women who are less than perfect. We live in a broken world. We live in a fallen world. We are all being carried toward completion. Let's stay humble. And let's love one another just as our Father in heaven has first loved us. We'll be back on the Pirate Monk Podcast.
Oh, a pirate's life is a wonderful life, a roving over the sea. Give me a career as a buccaneer, it's the life of a pirate for me. Oh, the life of a pirate for me.
And we're back. Well, Mondo, for years now, as I've traveled around the country and visited Samson meetings in, gosh, I don't know how many states, and spoken at conferences, and sat with guys one-on-one in coffee shops around the country, the question I've gotten more often than not, that first question has had something to do with my wife. People are curious about this woman. And they tend to get even more curious after they've read Samson and the Pirate Monks. And Allie, my dear bride, does not like the public eye. She often travels with me when I go to speak, but she seldom leaves the hotel room. She likes room service, and she likes the pool, and she likes her privacy. Here in Franklin, Tennessee, she does meet with other wives quite regularly on our front porch, and they'll share a cup of tea and a conversation. She's quite comfortable one-on-one with people that she knows, but she does not feel called to the same kind of public ministry that I do, which is why it is remarkable to me that at the suggestion of a visiting friend, she actually agreed to be interviewed for this podcast. So 2 weeks ago, we sat down in this room with Aaron Porter, one of the pastor pirates from San Luis Obispo, California, and he conducted an interview with me in the room. Mondo, what do you say we run that interview?
Yes, I have. Says I'm loving her early in the morning, just to me. Oh yeah, she said I'm loving her early in the morning, just to me. Oh yeah, yeah, she said I'm loving her just to me. Oh, I'm loving her tenderly. I got a woman now, well, darling, I wanna say good to me.
So I'm here in the room with a good friend of mine, one of Allie's favorite people in all the world, Aaron Porter. He's sitting almost knee to knee with my lovely bride, Allie. And
where are you sitting?
I'm sitting on the other side of the room.
That's right.
And Mondo's sitting in between us, so he doesn't have to look at me when I talk.
So take it away, guys.
All right. Now you're gonna stay quiet over there unless you absolutely have to chime in, right?
I will speak only in self-defense.
Fair enough. All right. So here we are. This is exciting. Allie, how many times have you said that you get a lot of questions from people when you go with Nate places? So I guess the first question is, what do you think people are most curious about? What do they come up and ask you when you go with Nate to different places?
Well, I don't. That's why I don't.
'Cause you...
I mean, no. I go with him places, but I don't go in with him when he speaks. I just stay at the hotel and read or meet other people, a lot, you know, if I have friends in the area. I'd never go in. And he's the one that keeps coming home and telling me, everybody wants to know about you, everybody wants to know about you, which is why I don't go.
So the follow-up question is, you don't go because you're afraid they would ask you what? But that doesn't seem like a, like, beginning of interview kind of question.
No. It's not I'm afraid. I love one-on-one with women. I love having people over my porch and having coffee and talking. It's that massive energy. I would not be able to, I'd lose myself in that massive energy.
Now, I gotta say, just getting to know Nate without knowing you, before the book and then with the book, he's very protective of not telling your story. He's telling his story.
Mm-hmm.
But then there's an implied story of here you are in the background. And I really appreciated meeting you because I realized how much he was protecting you, and you've got your own story to tell. So you ended up, I mean, you're fun, and you're loud, and you're not, I think I always pictured like the mousy woman in the background that was the victim, you know, and
well, I was the mousy woman in the background, the victim for a number of years. I was crazy fun when I was young, crazy fun as a teenager, and through the 60s I was crazy fun.
We'll come back to that.
Yeah, well, and then, you know, this particular part of my life was one where all my crazy funness went away, and I didn't even know who I was anymore, and now my crazy funness is back, so you, yeah.
So we'll take us through that a little bit, because, you know, give us A, the kind of thumbnail sketch of who is Allie, and then we come up to the place that Nate always says that you said you wouldn't have wished that he was dead, but if he was dead, that wouldn't. What's the quote? Give the quote exactly, Nate. I don't want to misquote.
Okay, here's
you
the quote.
You have permission.
The quote is, my wife told me recently that if I had died 12 years ago, she would have been relieved. She wasn't going to kill me, but she would not have objected if God did.
Yeah, that's pretty much how I felt.
Right. So take us from, I mean, this is really important.
Mm-hmm.
You have this, you're the child of the 60s, you're fun, you're, and then you marry Nate, and he comes.
I married the little golden boy of the North Country in the Pentecostal culture, whatever it is, yeah. And I was right off a hippie commune farm and just wanted to find, I knew, I've known God all my life, but when things went wrong, when I was little, things just sort of went crazy, and I just sort of left. I always knew God was me. I've always known it from the first time I can remember, but I just decided, I'm leaving you for a while. I know you're there, but I just can't deal with this, and I went and lived on hippie farms and stuff, and...
And then you found Jesus, like, when did that connection
make?
At the hippie farm?
Yeah. That's another whole story we don't have time to get into. But, yeah, so I moved out.
Mm-hmm.
David and I moved out, and I started to... We moved into Watertown, New York, which is the little town that Nate lived in. But he was... I didn't meet him for another year, because I had to... God had to get me to that church where he was, and...
Okay. Then what happened? You guys are at the church together.
We're not together. I was working in an ARC hostel. I had anywhere between 10 and 13, and I know the word retarded isn't publicly accepted anymore, but
disabled.
Disabled.
You're working with the disabled.
But I had I had a whole house full of women. I loved it. I loved it. It was like home. I loved them. I loved teaching them. You know, but of course I had a woman in there who did the really hard work, which was, you know, I'm never mind.
You just got to love on them.
I got to love on them. She sort of cleaned the house, you know.
There you go.
But that's my gift. Why are we here?
Well, you're getting now to the place where you met Nate.
Okay. I was living at the hostel and was invited to this Pentecostal church out in the country, and I went. And there he was. I had six of my girls with me. That's why I went there. I had six of my girls. I would bring them to church mm-hmm. on Sunday, even if I was off duty, because they just loved the music. They just loved it. So here I am with my little, as Nate called them, I look like a duck and her mother ducklings, in the back, on the left. And I looked over in the front on the right, and I see this beaming, smiling face. It just was like it was lit up. And he was looking at me, smiling. And I beamed and smiled back. And I knew right then, I remember saying to myself, I'm just going to wait right here because he's going to jump over the pew and race back here to see me when church is done. That's exactly what happened.
All right, pause here because this is worth bringing Nate back in. So we get the perspective from the back of the room with beaming Nate at the front, who's about to bound over the pews.
Oh, man, just this vision of energy and beauty. I mean, she was just an angel when she walked in that place. I was completely captivated.
And so after the service was done, you had to get to the back, and you were at the front. That's inconvenient. Was it a full day? Were there a lot of people to get through?
Oh, yeah. This was a happening church. Yeah, the place was full.
So we had a fight through the crowd.
He did jump over the pew.
He literally jumped over the pew.
That's it.
All right, so what was the conversation had then?
It wasn't much. It was like...
It was disappointing after the meeting.
My courage fled, you know, the closer I got to her. The more intimidated I was. And by the time I got there, I could barely speak.
So what did you say?
But I did get her name.
Which he got wrong once at the next meal thing. He called me Alicia. and he was trying to impress me. He comes up, just says to his cousin Tom, his brother-in-law Tom, what's her name? And he goes, Alicia. And he comes up to me and he goes, hi, Alicia. And I go, hi, and I bolted for the food.
So a rough beginning.
It was a rough beginning. And shortly after that, I learned that she was a scarlet woman.
Yes, I had a.
She had an 8-year-old son. She was divorced, and in our world at that time, that meant that she was off limits, especially for somebody destined to ecclesiastical greatness, as I was.
Right. So you were on the path to be the fulfillment of what a good Christian kid ought to become. And how did you?
I was too. I mean, I was on fire. I was just on fire.
So how did you feel about that scarlet letter? Did you feel
I was told by the church we were in. I never knew this before. Before that, you know, I was like, hey, live and let live. Do what you want to do. As long as you don't hurt anybody. You know, I had friends of every single kind of whatever.
Yeah,
you know,
the 60s
but now,
kid.
Yeah, I'm a 60s kid. Now, all of a sudden, you're only, because I was only supposed to associate with certain kinds of people.
So, what happened next? So, the courting began.
And I had been taught that the scripture, if anyone who marries a divorced woman commits sin, and I'd have people coming to my house with Bibles, and some of them would be saying, you're going to send him to hell. What are you doing? Stop. And other people would come and say, no, look, here it says that if you're, you know, you're a new creature in Christ and blah, 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 and all that. So three times, I think, I was brand new. I was brand new to all this, and I just wanted to be good. For the first time in my life, I wanted to just be good. So three times I tried to call off the wedding. I said, you know, I can't do this. If there's any remote chance, I'm going to send you to hell, because this is what I was taught. Mm-hmm. I can't do this. I'm not going to marry. And he was like, "What are you crazy? This is because tell him what the dream your father had."
Yeah, the turning point for us came when my dad, who'd always preached that very hard line, and preaching against divorce and remarriage was a major theme of his ministry as I was growing up. And really, if my father hadn't changed his mind, I don't know that I ever would have been able to change mine. Once I found out that she was divorced, then she was destined to be, at very best, you know, a great friend that I just happened to have, you know, a mad crush on. And I never disclosed that to my father. But he actually called me one day, one of the few times my dad actually called me. Called me to say that he had had a dream in which God had told him, "Who are you?" To define a sin as unforgivable. And he wanted me to know that he had changed his mind regarding divorce and remarriage. After that, the courtship moved rather quickly.
well, it moved quickly in that poor Nate was so, you know, I lived in a hostel, and he wasn't sure. He was very sheltered, you know, and so he would stand outside the house and wait for all the girls to go to bed, and then he'd come in. And he'd sit there. Do you know how he what a dork he was?
Tell us what a dork he was. We want to know.
It was so cute. He was trying to be romantic, but he didn't know how to be romantic. So he took a...
No, keep talking in the mic. Don't look at him. Don't look at him. Look at the mic.
He picked a flower for me.
I'm not going to help you humiliate me.
He picked a flower for me, and he said, This is a... What did you say?
All right. I said it was a pimento.
Pimento of my affliction.
Okay. It was charming.
A pimento of my affliction. It was so cute.
Okay.
He was trying to say affection of my, you know.
Yes. So you guys overcame got married.
Yes.
And
I lost half my wedding party. Not half. I lost a lot of my wedding party because their pastor was told they couldn't come to our wedding or they'd be condoning sin. So that was another whole thing that we got through, which made it really special. And I got a phone. I had my hand on the phone. This is really important to why I stayed. One of the reasons we stayed together. I was just going to call him and say, "I'm not doing this. I can't do this. I'm not going to send you to hell." And I had my hand on the phone, and I'm not saying God came through the clouds and appeared before me and spoke audibly, but it was as audible as it's possible to be. Mm-hmm. Said, "This is my wedding, not yours. Mm-hmm. And if you don't marry him, you're not following my will." And just the way it was said, I can't remember exact, but I knew it was like a voice. It was for me. And I hung up the phone, and I never had a doubt since then. So later on, when the years went by and things got really, really hard, I had that.
Now, I just have to, make a connection, and we're going to come back to this point in the story. But here you are at the beginning of your relationship with a scarlet letter on you, where the church mm-hmm. is saying, mm-hmm. how can you be useful as a wife?
Yeah.
And then how strange, as years have gone on, Nate, your whole ministry is characterized by a scarlet letter. The church would say, "How can you be useful?" Mm-hmm. And what an amazing thing how, if anyone actually reads the Bible, there's not a whole lot of people that weren't unfit to be the heroes of the faith. God seems to go to those who are, quote, unfit. Mm-hmm. And those are the people that he lifts up to do his work so mm-hmm. that he gets the glory. Mm-hmm. And I love that the beginning of the story is about, Nate, you overcoming all of the opinions of the church and saying, "You know what, forget that. You guys aren't seeing from God's eyes. You're afraid." And then as you guys continued, Allie, you had to say the same thing and mm-hmm. say, "You know what, okay. You think he can't minister because of this?
Mm-hmm.
I'm starting to see he's now a minister because of this."
Oh, yeah.
That's an amazing thing.
It is a really amazing thing. And one of my favorite scriptures that I've seen played out with both of us is somewhere, and I don't even know where it is. It says he takes your weaknesses and turns them into strengths. And if that's not true, my total weakness, his total weakness has been turned into strength, and not by us.
Yeah. Yeah. He's
not that, and I don't feel like I have a whole lot of strengths, but my weakest, the thing that was my weakest, is now my strongest.
All right, so we'll come back to that part. You guys get married. Mm-hmm. You're moving on. Nate's in ministry, and then things start to happen in his life that you're unaware of.
But no, something, I was aware of him.
What were you aware of?
I mean, we're talking about his addictions?
Yep, so we're getting to the place. Well, you guys are now married, and that's starting.
We're married. He went to Princeton, to seminary there, and that's where he got addicted. I don't know if he... I didn't read his book, so... I don't know whether he told that in his book.
You've still never read his book?
I'm not going to read his book. I told him that from the beginning, and he kept...
This is one stubborn woman.
He kept getting his feelings hurt, like, you're not going to read my book? And I'm like, I'm really sorry, I'm not going to read it. And you're not going to read my book. Finally, I don't remember what it was. He finally, something happened, and he saw something on TV or something, and he goes, oh, now I get why you don't want to read my book. Remember that?
Yeah,
I
do.
It wasn't that long ago.
Yeah.
I just don't want to go back there in my head.
Yeah. You have permission. Mondo and I give you permission to never read his book.
Thanks. Absolutely. Thanks.
That
plus, I would correct some of his... I'd also rewrite. I'd buy, this isn't a good sentence, and that's not how it happened. What are you talking about? And,
oh, no, you're coming off as a nag now. Let's just pass over that.
Well, that's the other half of it. Because we're critical of each other's books. I wrote a book once. Well, we won't go there either.
So, okay. Princeton, yeah.
Princeton, so that's where he got addicted. Mm-hmm. We went into that tour, right, into the city. Yep. They said they're doing a thing on
exploitation of women.
Yeah, something about, you know, this is, you know, we thought it was just, oh, it was called, the group was called Women Against Porn, and it turns out it was a trip into New York.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, we loved New York City. We'd go in a lot. Princeton's not that far. So we went in there, but they took us into these down to 42nd Street, which back then was really bad. It's not really now, but... And they took us into one of these triple X-rated places, and I don't know where my brain was. I was just following everybody. We went in, and they gave us tokens and put us in booths.
Yeah.
And that's not what I was thinking I came for, and I just wanted to throw up. I was just like, get me out of here. Ah. But, so we did get out of there, but I guess what happens is, in a guy's brain...
Whole different scenario.
He saw it, he couldn't get out of his head, and then he started acting on it, and we left Princeton. He was offered a church, and we both decided, no, let's go be part of a church. So we moved to South Florida, and we were part of a church. And at this point, he was... going to bookstores and stuff, I think. I don't think it was too much more than that. Then when we were in Florida, I think Kristen was 3, Daniel was 5, I think David must have been 16. He went to this thing called Crecio. It's some kind of weekend you go away on. And you want to just get 2 seconds on Crecio?
You've been offered 2 seconds.
I yield to the woman from Tennessee. 2 seconds. No, Crecio, a spiritual weekend. There's a Protestant version called Walk to Emmaus. Mm-hmm. And I heard somebody there for the first time make a confession of activity with pornography. And that gave me the courage when I got home to... be frank with Allie, and I told her about it.
Now, how did you react? How did you feel?
Well, like I said, I'm from the 60s. Mm-hmm. Wasn't anything new that I mean, I lived on communes where people, you know, anything goes. I was like, you know, I wasn't into that, but I was like, do whatever, you know, whatever doesn't hurt you. And so I felt bad for him, but as far as I knew, he was only... Mm-hmm. Looking at magazines.
Now,
I think.
Yeah, now I have to pause here in that.
Yeah.
Because as I, as a pastor, have to deal with wives getting that first news, and especially ones that didn't grow up in the 60s where you're actually coming into a very tame thing. And I think that's a part of your story I'm glad you're telling, that at the beginning here, this wasn't surprising or shocking because you came out of something that was...
Right.
Crazier. I mean,
and I've talked to enough women who haven't come out of that, who are so sheltered that all they have to hear is their husband look at a magazine, and they just don't know what to do with that. They just don't have any reference for that. It's very hard because it's a shock. Purity is what God is pure, and that's like not pure. And
Well, and I just have to say, yeah.
Purity.
And the guy is almost always saying, it's not about you. And the woman is almost always feeling, well, of course it is. I'm not pretty enough. I'm not beautiful enough. I'm not sexy
enough.
Exactly. And both are right. From the guy's perspective, it's not that he's necessarily going to lose sexual interest in his wife. That's where it's not about her, that it's just a whole separate thing that his wife can't understand. But she's also right that she is connected to it. So even here where Nate's telling you, it's not disconnected because God's joined this husband and wife as one. So this activity is connected to her. So both of them are kind of hitting and missing at the same time. And it can be confusing whether they respond like you or whether they get really freaked out mm-hmm. by it. So it's a big moment when a husband feel safe, and how a wife responds either proves she is safe or unsafe.
Well, that's right. That's why I tell some people, you know, it's not for everybody to just blab, throw it all out in front of your wife to get rid of your guilty conscience. Now I feel better. I told you all while she's in a puddle on the floor.
Mm-hmm.
But there are other women who just they I want to know. I want to know everything. Tell me everything right now. And then everybody's different.
Right. Now, after confessing, what did you think would happen, Nate, that now that you've confessed, it would just...
Well, I felt so good afterwards. I mean, I felt so clean, and she was so brave and so accepting. And I thought, man, this is it. I've cracked the code. This is how you do it. I just make my wife my accountability partner.
And then
I could see that she was not able to be as objective about it as she wanted to be, that it did affect her emotionally.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's when I realized you were going into places, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. That took it to another level for me.
Yeah. And so I eventually just assured her that it was done, that I was fine.
So you started hiding it not because she was getting angry and making herself unsafe, because you saw that it was hurting her.
Yes.
So you protected her by keeping your own secrets.
Well, that's how I sold it to myself anyway.
Mm-hmm. No, that's how he sold it to himself.
Yeah.
But
I do think that there was some truth to that.
Well, here's the other side of that. When you really want to do the right thing and you've been brought up a certain way and now you're doing something that is so absolute opposite of what you always brought up to be, your conscience just starts to bother you. And you're constant, you know, and you start getting mad at yourself. Then you start hating yourself and you're out there being bravado and this and that. Mm-hmm. But meanwhile, you're hating yourself for this double life because you do have a conscience and you don't like being like this. So then we reached the point where his hatred of himself started spilling over onto me.
Okay, so he's starting to, this is growing inside of you.
So it's not helping me. It's not helping
right.
me because I'm thinking, what is wrong with me? What am I doing that's making him so mad? What am I doing that he thinks I'm the stupidest person in the world? What am I doing? And I thought that it's all me and I really am stupid. I'm just stupid and I lost who I was. I lost the fun person. I lost who I was and I went into, I'm just some stupid person who will never amount to anything, and I'm going to throw my life into my kids, and I babysat, and I love kids, so I just threw myself into mm-hmm. little kids.
So the protection idea did not protect, but it,
right.
in the end, spilled over in all the unspoken emotional ways, and you just kind of disappeared into yourself.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I think it's important, you know, we talked about whether or not you want to talk about one of your children's feelings through that, about not just how you felt, but how he saw that in you.
Mm-hmm.
And then how that changed. So do you want to tell that story?
Yeah, he grew up...
We're talking about our youngest son now.
Yeah, our youngest son, who is, you know, 28 now. Okay, I'll start with when Nate gave him the book. Nate finished the book, wrote the book, and that's another thing, how the book got written. when he gave it to our kids, he sat down with each kid and explained to them what had gone on all their lives that they had no idea of.
So up to this point, they knew nothing.
He was a great father. They loved their dad. I mean, we'd go on weekends. That's the only time we had any respite from all this, is we'd go to the beach and rent a place for the weekend, and all of us would have a wonderful weekend. But he was better to the kids than he was to me.
And he would terrorize ex-boyfriends, all that kind of stuff. That's a different story.
No, he and I did that together.
Okay, all right.
We did
have
some things we did together. And where was I?
Gave the book a weekend.
Okay.
Sat down.
So he gave it to each of our kids and told them the story. And our kids are amazing. I mean, they're just amazing. And each of them were so proud of their dad. And they were just, you know. But it was maybe a year after, or maybe not even a year, my Daniel, who is my baby, you know, called me up, and he was crying. He was just sobbing. And I said, "Daniel, are you okay?" He goes, "Mom," he said, "Nate, Dad told me, and I read the book, and I just want to tell you that I am so, so, so sorry." I said, "For what? What are you sorry for?" He goes, "All those years growing up, I saw you crying a lot. I just saw this weak person. And I just guess because you were crying a lot and you were weak, I loved you, but I didn't respect you. So I always grew up thinking I had a weak mom." He goes, "Now I've just found out what you actually were going through during that time. You are the strongest person I know, and you are my hero." Mm-hmm. And my heart just melted. And at that point, it's funny because before that, he's a really likable guy. He's just a lovable guy. But he seemed to attract these crazy girlfriends. Just crazy.
Mm-hmm.
They'd always, you know, well, never mind. But after that, after Nate told them that, and Daniel called me, his whole taste in women changed.
Mm.
All of a sudden, he didn't date for a while, and then he met Jenny. And he's married to Jenny. We love Jenny. They're two peas in a pod. They're the happiest little couple we've ever seen. Well, all of our kids are happy, but that was powerful for me because it showed that he was picking crazy people because he thought his mother was crazy, you know?
Mm.
And when he realized the truth of what was going on, it changed his whole life.
Well, two things there. Number one, the views and opinions expressed by Allie Larkin are not necessarily the views and opinions about the crazy girlfriends, in case you're listening, of SamsonSociety.org. But the second thing...
You know who you are.
The second thing is, what a powerful thing for guys to hear right now on this podcast when they think, okay, I'm dealing with it. It's not affecting my family. You didn't know what was affecting you, but it was affecting you. And then your kids had, you know, they were even more removed. And yet how amazingly affected they were by these secrets, that it's trickling down in ways you couldn't possibly know.
I know.
And guys have to understand this. That,
yeah, I mean, their dad can be wonderful to them. But if he's not wonderful to their mom, they're still going to have a big link there.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
All right, so this is important Allie stuff. So you go through 20 years of this.
Mm-hmm.
So we get up towards you're now into your kids, you've tried to numb it, you're self-soothing with these activities so that you don't have to deal with it.
Mm-hmm.
And what happens next?
Are we still in Florida or have we moved here?
Oh, let's move here.
Okay, well, we moved here under really joyful circumstances, but there were many, many things that happened during the move. Our oldest son, David, and his wife, Sam, were going to have a baby. They did an internet search to find out the best place to raise kids in America. They typed in everything they wanted. It came out Franklin, Tennessee, so they moved to Franklin from California so we could be grandparents.
Clearly they didn't type in weather, but sorry, that's California guy here. All right, keep going.
Oh, yeah, you California people think your weather's the best.
Yeah, all right.
Okay. So the thing was that Nate had been trying and trying. By this time, he didn't have any recovery. He was getting so bad that he was disappearing he would just disappear for days, but like hours and hours. And, well, it just got really bad. And I was ready to leave. I was like, I can't do this anymore. I'm not going to do this anymore. And then this move to Tennessee came. I told him, I said, you know what? This is good. We'll move to Tennessee. I said, I'll never divorce you. I love you. You're my best friend. And I just, you know, but you live upstairs. I'll live downstairs. You have your friends. I'll have my friends. You go to your church. I'll go to my church. We'll just live like that. Then we won't have all this tension. And so, well, geez, I don't have time for that one. So we got here. So we got here, and he found, you probably should tell, you could do this better than me, Nate.
Yeah, well, I've told the story about you finding me downloading porn after we started running short on money.
Oh, yeah, well, that was...
Yeah.
Had you started going to meetings by then?
Nope, hadn't started meetings.
Oh.
And then a couple of weeks later, you found the condom in the bathroom.
Oh, but I thought that this was a whole new life coming here because of what happened on the way up.
Yeah,
had an accident on the way up, and this whole scene played out that cleared my head, and I thought, oh my gosh, the light has come, this is a bubble, everything's fine.
See, this is why we should have written the book together. Then we could have gotten our story straight.
And I thought, we're going to Tennessee, and life is going to be new, and everything's, you know, I came at this in this huge bubble, and expected that miraculously, all of our problems were going to disappear. You know,
do you think that's common for women that without the work, they're hoping this circumstance or that's just going to miraculously change everything?
Oh yeah.
And it did feel new when we got to Florida.
Oh, it was
which is why the crash was so shattering.
We were like in heaven. We were best friends again. Everything, the world was wonderful and good. And then I found him looking at, I came downstairs in the, and God did this with me. He just exposes everything one way or another. I woke up, I came downstairs, and there he was looking at it in the dark. And all I could see from the light, from the reflection, was the look on his face. And it just, I don't even remember what, I just remember that. I don't remember after that. But then I found the condom in the bathroom. It wasn't opened, but it was on the floor. And I'm like, my bubble burst. It's like, I thought everything was, you know, you stupid, stupid person. You'd keep thinking everything's going to change and things don't change. So,
and we have to reflect back to the time that you confessed for the first time.
Mm-hmm.
That we have a lot of manufactured this changes everything moments.
Oh yeah.
But we don't bring community into that.
Right.
And it's just the stuff that makes it all artificially go away.
And it makes for addictions, because addictions can make you go away. And I knew that's why he was doing them. I mean, I understand it.
So,
but I didn't know the whole story at that point. I really didn't. I didn't know the whole story.
But you were more aware. It wasn't like the condom on the bathroom wasn't the first moment. You've been,
I knew,
from for years, you've been at least aware.
Oh.
And so,
for years, in the beginning, I knew about the pictures, and then I knew about the places he went into, and by the time we came here, I knew he was probably, probably been to some in Nashville. But that's as far as I thought they went, and I never let my head imagine what went on inside those places, because I'm real good at denial. I'm really, really. That's a protection I've developed over the years. So I just, I know he's in those places. I know they're awful. I don't know what to do about it. He can go live upstairs. I'm not living with this. Not because of that so much as how he acted towards me when he acted out.
Mm-hmm.
It's like when you act out, I know exactly when you did, because you just get mean. You get defensive. I can say one word and you'll snap at me, and I know you're back to hating yourself again. And I would confront him and say, okay, is it me? Am I doing something wrong? Are you angry at me? Am I being an ass? Whatever. Or have you slipped? And most of the time he had slipped. Sometimes I'd been...
So, Nate, here's a question for you. Do you think guys... did you believe let me phrase it like this. Did you know how obvious you were being when you were acting out?
No, I had no clue.
So you thought you were actually doing a good job of acting out and hiding.
Oh, man, I was so far removed from my real life and so out of touch with my real self. I had no clue.
So do you think there's a lot of guys out there that think, oh, I have this secret life, my wife knows nothing, but, I mean, Ali's just said it was totally obvious every time he acted out, he came home and acted a certain way, and she was aware.
And I would say over and over, look, I know you're struggling, I know you're having issues. Like I said, I didn't know the worst part yet, but if you could just tell me, you know, when you slip, I was still calling it slip at that time, I don't anymore. If you could tell me when you slip, at least I'll know. I won't go through this agony of wondering, what did I do? Am I an idiot? And why are you mad at me? And blah, blah, blah. And I'll just be able to say, thank you for telling me. At least go be a jerk, but go be somewhere else and don't make me feel bad. But it took him he couldn't do that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
For a long time.
So do you think, Nate, there are guys listening right now that are self-deluded enough to be acting out and think that they are not acting in such a way that their wives are aware of?
Oh, sure.
So what do we say to those guys?
I don't know what we say to those guys.
We're not condemning those guys.
Oh, no.
We get it.
No. You know, addiction robs us of self-awareness. We actually have to go into a disassociative state. We're out of touch with what's going on. And we wind up, as active addicts, being much bigger jerks than we think we're being. Mm. Doing far more damage than we know we're doing. And because, you know, it takes a certain amount of denial for this to function on both. You know, it took for us to stay married, Allie and I both had to be masters of denial. But our kids, but both of us on one level were aware of the misery. Certainly, Allie was in clinical depression by the time we moved here, and our kids were certainly aware of it. We worked hard to maintain a different view of the family, an official view of the family.
Mm-hmm.
But everybody knew the misery.
So, guys, dealing with it alone, think your wife is not involved. Just hear what Allie's saying. This is years of her being far more aware than Nate could have ever imagined. And so, take that for what it is. You're getting the whole story here. All right, so, go on.
Okay, so then he wanted to write the book. He went to SAA, and he saw a lot of sobriety there, but he just needed, I don't know, what did you need more?
Well, I needed to integrate recovery when that came with my Christian faith, and so with some brothers here in Franklin, we started the Samson Society, and about a year into Samson, began to think that we ought to tell this story so that other guys could start something like Samson.
So, right. Did you see a difference? I mean, he's now gone into, he went into a 12-step program, and all of a sudden it's like, wow, okay.
No, it was a very slow, you know, it took a long time, and it took me a long time to trust him.
Mm-hmm. And we're talking a 6-year process here.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, he got to the place where he was doing his amends and explained what amends were, that you know, whatever you've done to hurt other people, you need to make amends to them for, he said, and you know, you already know everything I've done, or not everything, he says, all I can tell you is that I'm not going to sit here and just dump every single thing I've ever done out on your lap, all over you, but I will promise you this, that I will never lie to you again, and you can ask me anything you think you need to know or want to know, you can ask me. So, I don't know. I don't even know why I said it. I would have staked my life on that the answer would have been no. But out of my mouth comes, have you ever, you know, had sex with anybody else? And it was sort of half a joke, I think, because, you know, and he just looked at me and he didn't say anything and he didn't talk. And I'm like, oh my God. And so that led to the fact that he had been seeing prostitutes for I don't know how many years that were what year that started, but I just sort of felt my bottom drop out of my stomach. I just sort of felt sick, and I don't really remember what I did. It was like I couldn't believe it. It was like I was seeing a cartoon or something, because it took me a while to even... And then I'm very visual. You tell me something, mm-hmm. and I picture it, so I'm trying to get all these images out of my head. Mm-hmm. And it took me... That was a shock. Because I've, you know... And porn is one thing. And another thing is, I've always said to him, you know... If a person's addicted to porn, if they have a problem, if they have issues, I know it comes from childhood hurt, I know all that and everything, but I can stick with you through issues that you can fix, but the only way I would ever leave is if you had an emotional mm-hmm. attachment to somebody else.
Right.
You know, that would kill me, and that would be it. But prostitutes, that was still, it's like if I had known back when I first found out, or back when we lived in Florida, mm-hmm. when we had kids in the house. I don't know. I mean, I think that's why it was just kept from me.
So what did you do then? Here you are in a state of shock, and you guys were able to move forward.
I think I went to bed for like... How long did I go to bed for? 6 months or something.
Okay.
Yeah, I just...
Rip Van Alley went to sleep for 6 months.
Yeah, it was like... Go away. Don't talk to me. I don't want to see you. Just stay out of my way. And I don't know. How long did that go on?
My memory of that time is hazy, but I do remember that we went to see the marriage counselor, K.K. Ray, with our plan. Our plan was, you'd come up with it, and I'd agreed to it, that I'd move out for a time, and we'd start to date again.
Right, and the reason that would be doable is because our daughter had just bought a house around the corner from us, but she still had 6 months lease left on her apartment, so it was available, and he could just move right in. I said, yeah, you can pick me up, we'll go out to dinner, and we'll pick me up, we'll go to church, but we need to just way back on all this till I can get it all figured out in my head. And I told that to KK, who laughed in my face.
And said, or was it just laughing and then your time's up?
No laughing. She goes, she's funny. She laughs at me anyway. She goes, you're the funniest person I ever heard of. That's so funny. Ha, 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 ha. And I'm like, why? Why is that funny? It made total sense to this day. We can talk about that and she'll still start laughing. I still don't understand why, but she thought it was funny. So she said, no, that wouldn't be a good idea. And Nate was very relieved.
Yeah, I was, frankly. She helped us work out the terms of an in-house separation. And so we kind of kept clear of each other. But were kind to each other in our interactions. As Allie got used to, and it took time for her to get used to this new reality. She was living with a man who had been unfaithful to her. And not one or two times.
So, what did it take where you finally got over that hump and said, all right, I do love this person, and I'm supposed to be with this person, and now it's time to reconcile this relationship?
Well, a lot of time.
Okay.
I mean, I never, ever wanted to leave him, 'cause God had just spent too much time getting us together, putting us together, showing us we're supposed to be together. I just thought we failed miserably, and we might as well just live it out. And I don't really remember a whole lot about that time. I remember I was depressed, but I remember Nate then started going to Samson. Oh, the book. Was that when you started writing the book?
Yeah, we started Samson. About a year after we started Samson, I started the book.
Okay, so he started the book. And I asked one thing of him. I asked, you know, write the book, do a good book, you're a good writer, but just please, whatever you do, don't say what your addiction is. Because, oh my gosh, it's just, I didn't want people, it's telling the whole world, people, your family and friends and people you've known for years. And he was a pastor, you know, and he was, you know, president of a Christian school, and they had no idea the struggles, you know. And
so you're asking them both to keep the image alive and be vague in confession.
Well,
both,
you know,
strong Samson principles.
I felt like such a hypocrite because I felt like we back there, we had lived like hypocrites, but the truth was that we just didn't know what to do with it. We didn't know who to go to with it. He went to some elders. He went to a couple pastors. He actually talked to our pastor because I think somebody, he had run into somebody else there who had told our pastor. Nobody knew what to do with him. He couldn't get sober. He couldn't get, you know, so it's not like he was not really, I knew how hard he was trying. He even went to AA, went to the head of the AA. He's like, I'm in trouble, help. So the move to Florida was like God starting us all over again. Tennessee. So where was I?
So he's writing the book, but you're asking him not to,
specific. Because of all these people in our past, because of everybody, and because I'm afraid that people at our church, mothers are going to grab their kids and just pull them away from him, thinking he's, you know, some kind of horrible pervert or something. I just was, once again, trying to save his reputation. When we were in Florida, I never breathed a word about this to anybody, which made me also feel like more of a hypocrite. But I don't like to, I didn't want to tell his sin to somebody else, and anyway, so he said, okay, I'll write the book. I won't mention what it is. Apparently, he had a lot of trouble writing the book. He couldn't get going. It just wasn't flowing.
Yeah, you got through, what, a whole half chapter or so?
Well, the day we had the turning point conversation, I'd worked all day and had written a paragraph, and it was crap.
So a crappy paragraph and an entire work day.
Right, and meanwhile, 3 weeks before that, or a while before that, a friend of his called him and said, my mother's got this shopping addiction, and it's so bad. We're broke. She's just driving us broke into the ground. Can you help me? Can you help me find a place to send her? So he did a search for somewhere he could send her, and that was one of my issues, shopping. Because when I feel, well, nobody's taking care of me, I'll take care of myself, you know? And I, you know, wasn't spending bill money, but I knew I was addicted to a thing. Buying something really nice would make me feel good in the middle of all that depression. You know that old George Burns Gracie Allen where Gracie says, George, every time I am down in the dumps, I get a new hat. And he goes, oh, so that's where you get them. You know,
yeah, I remember that.
Remember that? Oh, that's right. You weren't even born yet.
Oh.
Anyway,
keep
but
going,
that's
keep
an
going.
Old, old joke, and right. It's true. Women, you know, if you're down in the dumps, you buy a new hat. So,
you have said don't be specific, and now you're realizing shopping is.
So he finds this place to send this mother to, and he says to me, you know what, you've been really struggling with this and saying how you wish you could stop doing this. Why don't you look into going there? And at that point, I was sort of desperate. I knew I had issues. I knew I, you know, I could be addicted to anything myself except sex, which I told him once. Regretfully. So I went to this 30-day program. And
so it's an in-house 30-day program?
It's an in-house 30-day program. And I went for shopping, but most of the people there were in for drugs and alcohol. They were mostly young kids. But anyway, everything I heard there over the next 2 weeks, things that I didn't even know about, I learned a lot about what's going on out there. So I called him and I said, you know what? Do it. It needs to be done. Having been in here for 2 weeks, listening to what these people are talking about, you need to write the book.
The whole book.
The whole book and leave nothing out.
How did that feel to you, getting that call?
Oh, man. I couldn't believe it was my wife on the phone saying that. And I wrote chapter one in a day.
So this was a reclaiming... It's the reclaiming of Fun Alley. This was like, I'm not protecting anything anymore. I'm not playing a game anymore. And the fact that you were willing to go into rehab just to say, like, okay, I know I've got this thing going on in my life. I'm going to go away for 30 days. Like, that's a courageous thing. Most people will never do. And in there, you started getting insights that started reclaiming who God made you to be. You didn't play the game.
It was the best thing that ever happened to me. We did lessons. We had, you know, took lessons on family structure and boundaries. And there was this woman there who, for whatever reason, took a special interest with me and listened to me and told me things that totally, epiphanies that changed my life. And not that she took a special interest in me time-wise over anybody else, but she got me.
Yeah.
She got me, and I it was amazing. So I came home very prepared.
And I'm sure you understood Nate as well, because you got the bigger picture.
Right.
I just feel like every person ought to at one point be in a 12-step program or a rehab like that, because we all self-soothe. Mm-hmm. And I think it's unfortunate that guys feel like, okay, many times we have an overt addiction. It might be to, you know what, I got to drink X amount to feel okay here. I've got to look at porn. Those types of things we say, oh, well, that's morally unacceptable. But what do women do?
Mm-hmm.
They're control freaks. They're addicted to controlling everything.
Absolutely.
They're terrified. Fear addicts.
Absolutely.
But these are, nobody's going to call you on these addictions.
And addicted to stuff, too.
Shopping.
I mean,
and and certainly some
and
women.
And looking good and having a certain look and your makeup and your hair, and you have to be perfect, and don't dare let anybody know that your deep, dark secrets. But we learned you're as sick as your secrets.
Yeah, so I'm giving all the asides in case the viewers are thick or stupid. Viewers. What?
Well, you just lost them.
Yeah, I just lost them. I'm doing all the asides. So, listeners, here's the aside. We all need to be about recovery, because it's about trusting God and learning to live lives of faith where we don't have to self-soothe with all of these acceptable or unacceptable. It's not just about the unacceptable, but even the acceptable ways that we get our lives under control without Jesus Christ.
Yeah, and those things become idols. Those little things become idols in our lives, things that we make most important, and then we make everything, including ourselves, less important. And we all have them, because we all have that proverbial hole in our heart, the God-shaped hole in our heart that only God can fill. And it sounds so trite, but it is so incredibly deeply true.
Yeah.
That you're going to fill it with everything you can. TV, movies, I mean, fantasy, housework. You can even fill it with religion, empty religion.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm 64 now. I'm just beginning to learn how to do that really, really honestly. Well, probably not real honest, but the layers, you know, more honestly than ever.
So that's the beginning of a journey where you guys, here it is, it's all on the table. And and because it was in print, you couldn't turn back. This started a journey for both of you that, I mean, in what ways have you fallen more in love with your husband since then?
I've fallen in love with him because he loves himself again, and has therefore fallen madly back in love with me again. In our communication, which we always had from day one, the first day we met, we have a lot of the same history, you know, childhood history. The day we met, we just bonded like soulmates. Like, I don't know. It doesn't happen with everybody.
Mm-hmm.
Some people get married and don't even know their husband or wife. But there was a connection there that wasn't gone for a while, but it was just in the murky muck for a while.
Very, really deep.
And now it's like it's been resurrected and it's better than ever. And we just, you know, he works during the day, I do whatever, and then we sit down, have a couple beers, play cards, talk over the day, over a game of nines, have dinner, and he goes to bed at 9, and I usually stay up later, but we've had good connection. And
so, Nate, in what ways have you fallen more in love with Allie since the time that the real journey started?
You know, I cannot believe, I'm so fortunate to be married to this vibrant, beautiful woman, and I cannot believe how I allowed myself through 2 decades to be blinded to her beauty. by fantasy images. And to walk, you know, I can't believe that I walked away from my own life and from our own marriage. I mean, I was in it physically, but was not in it mentally, emotionally, spiritually. And to be back there again, this is what life's about. I love coming home to Allie. I love waking up with Allie. I learn new things about her all the time. I mean, 2 days ago I learned that her favorite number was 43. I didn't know
32.
That.
32.
What?
Well, so you sort of
32.
Learned.
32.
Okay. You learned she had a favorite number.
I learned that she had a favorite number.
Oh, that's classic.
My memory is also failing me, but...
I had a favorite number. He never knew that.
That's right. Let's stick with that.
Okay, and yeah. Your second favorite number was 14. I do
that's
remember
right.
that.
That's
okay.
Right.
She not only had a favorite number, she had a second favorite number.
And it was... Go ahead.
It was 14.
And it was 14.
I got that one right.
Hey, 50-50 ain't bad.
Yeah.
So, all
and
right.
I'm just so grateful that... that we were able to stay married. It's a gift that not every guy in recovery gets, or every woman in recovery gets. Not every marriage survives disclosure.
And I don't think all of this very controversial, but I don't think all marriages should necessarily. I don't think divorce is not an option sometimes.
Yeah, it's certainly in the case of adultery.
The church says, you know, don't divorce, work it through. But I think if my husband actually fell in love with somebody else, that would kill me. That would kill my heart. That would kill my heart.
And the beauty of grace is we never know what we can do, what God will give us the strength for until we're there.
True.
And that when we get in those moments, God gives us things that we never expected.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's why it's the day-by-day trusting.
Yeah.
So, Allie, I'm going to let you close with this. What is the thing that you just think, all right, people got to understand this about me? What would you say? All the Samsonites out there, the handbags, the large luggage, all that, what do they need? That was a luggage joke. All right, so what do they need to know about Allie Larkin? Here we go. The closing comment. I'll keep talking until I see in your eyes you've got something.
I just don't know what you mean.
What you want them to understand about Nate's wife.
Nate's wife loves Nate more than I ever could imagine I ever would be able to love anybody. And... he's my best friend, and my life with him, I can't imagine my life without him. I love my children, I love my grandchildren, and I love watching Nate with the grandchildren. Makes my heart just melt when they see him and they light up, and I feel like the most fortunate person in the world, and sometimes I have to not feel guilty. I sit out on my front porch from my swing with my coffee, with the sun coming through the trees in the morning, and I'm like, I am the most fortunate person in the world.
And sin tried to rob you both of all of that, but grace prevailed.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Nate, you want to sign us off with a special edition?
Well, I'm going to try and gather myself here after, I mean... what man doesn't love to hear his wife say that she loves him? Thank you, Allie.
Thank you. Thank you for ask me to marry you.
The listeners will work that out as Nate signs off.
I'll just say, well, guys, and pirate monks chick monks, that's it. Pirate monks and chick monks out there, you have just met her. That's my bride. That's the Allie Larkin that I love, and I'm glad you've gotten to know her a little bit.
There is a joy in the journey. There's a light we can love on the way. There is a wonder and wildness to life. Freedom for those
Well, there you have it. Allie Larkin in her own words. Hope you enjoyed that interview. And sorry, guys, I got her first. She's a great lady, and I'm keeping her. And for some crazy reason, she's keeping me. Well, we'll be back next week. Until then, we'd love to get your comments, your questions, your suggestions. You can send them to us at letters@samsonsociety.org. See you next week on the Pirate Monk Podcast.
To all who've been born of the Spirit and who share incarnation with Him, who belong to eternity, stranded in time and weary of struggling with sin. Forget not the hope that's before you, and never stop counting the cost. Remember the hopelessness when you were lost. There is a joy in the journey.